This is the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. Join us as Canada's cinematographers discuss the tools and techniques they use in shaping the aesthetics of their current projects.
This podcast features Director of Photography Daniel Grant, CSC, in conversation with Carolyn Wong, board member of the CSC. Daniel discusses his work on the documentary, The Messenger. This interview was recorded on May 8th, 2016 in Toronto, Ontario. We're here with Daniel Grant, and we're going to talk about the documentary, The Messenger, which is doing very well in the festivals and is getting awards. Now, I wanted to know how you got the project.
Actually, it was another filmmaker named Cassandra Nicolau, who's a director that I've worked with on a number of short films. And we had been doing some, I think we were shooting a teaser for a feature that she wanted to put together that was like a love story between a birder and an arborist. And she's friends with Sue Reinhardt, the director of The Messenger. And I think we were actually borrowing her camera. And there was one of those like little crossover things where she was just getting her film off the ground, and Cassandra's film wasn't quite ready to go. So yeah, that's how I met Sue.
All right, and suggested you, and you went with it.
Yeah, Cassandra suggested me, that's right.
Now, what kind of preparations did you do once you found out about the project? Mm-hmm. Did you know what it was about? Because it's about, migration of birds and how, mm-hmm. and climate change and the environment. So how much prep and discussion did you have with Sue setting that?
Quite a bit. You know, the nature of the project was such that, like, it was scheduled a lot more precisely than most documentaries usually are. She had quite a few different funders involved that all expected different versions of the film, essentially, like for... It was a co-production, France-Canada co-production, and so it was Arte in France. They had commissioned two hour-long, and then that was going to be French language. And then CBC had also commissioned an hour-long TV piece for The Nature of Things. And then they also had funding to do a feature. So, and all of these had slightly different considerations.
Oh, so you were shooting for three kind of versions.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah. You kind of had to keep that in mind.
Yeah, plus there's also, it was an online component too, which is kind of, this is, I guess, the reality of documentary funding these days, is that it needs to be cobbled together from all these different sources, and especially for a project like this, which is pretty expansive. So basically, we only had so many days, so it had to be scheduled quite precisely. So we kind of knew what we were getting into with each block of shooting. But it was kind of spread out over probably a year and a half, it would be 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because the birds migrate when they migrate.
Mm-hmm,
so you guys had to schedule mm-hmm. to follow that.
Yeah.
So this sort of precise scripting and scheduling, technically, like gear-wise or what you mm-hmm. had to anticipate, what kind of things did, can you tell me about that?
There were a few different types of shooting that we knew we were going to do. The main part really was actually following the scientists and showing their process of research, because that's where the evidence comes from to show the decline of these songbird populations. So we knew that we were going to be shooting kind of verite style, this scientist doing this research. You know, for example, the film begins and ends with this bird banding sequence, which is where these little devices are placed on birds. In this case, they were purple martins. This was in Ithaca. We shot this. They would fly down to Brazil or something like that. They'd make this trip. It's like over the course of a couple weeks or something. It's crazy how fast they do it. And then they come back to the exact same spot, the exact same bird colony. And we actually, because of when we started shooting, we filmed the return first. And then about a year later, or rather that was in the springtime. And then in the late fall after that, we filmed the birds being banded. So we kind of did that out of sequence just by necessity. So that was one type of shooting. And then the other part was the actually shooting the birds, which there are kind of different units going on, different shooting units. Like, we were responsible for all of the scientist stuff, and then for us the birds were almost like target of opportunity, because the reality is that with wildlife photography, you could be waiting for weeks to get a shot of like one specific bird.
That's right. Oh, so I guess you were like the lead DP that sort of oversaw and sort of, you know, how did that work? Because you were right. saying that there's other units out
That's
there.
That's right. Yeah.
So who was that? And how did that work?
Well, I did all of the North American and kind of Central American stuff. And then there was a team in France who did all the European shooting. And that was Amar Ahmed, who was a DP in France, who did beautiful work on it. And then there were a number of specific kind of wildlife cinematographers who had expertise in the area of shooting birds that were tasked with getting like specific birds. And it's funny because when we started, Joanne, the producer, I think, said to me, like, you know, we can afford such and such number of bird shots. And it was something like, I can't remember what it was, but it was like 20 something bird shots in a feature about birds. But it's very expensive because, you know, if you need a specific bird, you have to...
It's a stakeout.
Yeah, you hire somebody to be in the bush for 3 weeks and they have a list of, you know, what they need to get. And so for us, we knew that there would be certain birds that would be easy for us to shoot, because there would be these bird boxes or the, in the case of the purple martin colony, there's these kind of like these giant bird houses that, you know, 20 purple martins live in, and you know where they're going to be, and we're going to be there following the human characters at the same time so we can film them too. But we didn't do a lot of, there were a couple of circumstances where we kind of had our bird stakeouts, but it wasn't that often because we just didn't have the time.
And Was it Joshua Sue that's your bird specialty guy?
That's, well, yeah, Joshua, he was a researcher on the film. And then, I guess, I mean, he kind of did everything. He was like our guy that did everything. And so I was never quite sure actually what, you know, his title was, but he did everything. And what was great about Josh is that he's an experienced bird photographer. And he is actually, he was working with one of the scientists that we followed. So he knows the science. So we would travel together, and, you know, he was kind of my assistant at first, but he had totally had the ability to shoot. So he had a Canon C100. So what we did is we got an external recorder for him because we couldn't really afford a full second camera package. And we did this more and more as we went on. Basically, when we were shooting in any particular location, we would be following, you know, the scientists, and, you know, he would just go off on his own. And that worked out really well. I think most of the bird shots in the film are Josh's.
Right, just like the long lens isolated ones in their natural habitat.
Exactly.
There's some really amazing at the beginning in certain parts of the film, that's the high speed.
Right.
Otherwise, like, who did that? Did you do that, or how is that?
I did that. Oh, so that was an interesting process. That was probably the hardest stuff I've ever shot, like in any movie.
I was trying to think, how did you do that?
Okay.
They're suspended in black.
Yeah.
They go in slow-mo. You can be forgiving about the focus because it is what it is. But it was like, wow.
Right. Well, that was a bit of a crazy shoot. But I was at a certain advantage because in the research part of the film, when they were putting together a trailer, Sue shot with Kim Durko because they've worked together. Kim shot Sue's dramatic feature called Cardia, which is a beautiful film. And so thankfully, I wasn't the first person who attempted to do this because it was really hard. So actually, I think Kim worked out a lot of the issues. But this is a hyperbaric chamber, basically a wind tunnel. These birds have been captured and have been trained to fly in this. It's called a hyperbaric chamber because what they do is they reproduce the conditions at which birds fly at night. And then so this allowed us to film these birds because it's a glass. It's hard to describe. It's like a
Wind tunnel in blue glass.
It's not that big. It's not that big. What was so difficult about it was that the birds, they fly at night and they don't like light. And of course, if you're shooting, we shot this on Phantom, and if you're going to shoot 1,000 frames per second, you need a lot of light. It's surrounded by plexiglass, and the reflections are an issue, and that was something I knew about because of this previous shoot that they did that was a big problem. So we took 2-inch black cloth tape, and we lined the entire inside of it so that there would be no reflections, which That would, problem was on camera, the reflections would be an issue, but also the birds, it confused them. Because basically, if they see an opening or if they see something that looks like a light source, they may fly towards it. And there was a lot of concern around safety for the birds from the, because the scientists really didn't want anything. They didn't want them to be in distress, and they certainly didn't want them to get injured. Yeah, so we did this, and then if you imagine, it's kind of like an shaped like an octagon. So in the top, basically what I did is, and I had my gaffer Igor Alves help me with this, so we brought these one-by-one light panels, because there's very little room around this hyperbaric chamber, and we just put those in a line across the top and layered it with diffusion, so it's almost like the way you would light a car commercial.
Like a big soft box.
Yeah,
very gentle.
Yeah.
So like, was this box like, what, 10 by 10 feet, 5 by 5 feet?
It was probably about 8 feet long and about maybe 3 feet wide, like a tube. So we would try to find a way to light it that would create the least amount of distraction for the birds and still give us enough
light for exposure.
And my theory was kind of that if you almost lit the birds more with a reflection than light, like in the way that, because the birds are somewhat reflective. They all kind of have different properties. Even the darker birds, you know, at the right angle, there's a reflection on them. So I thought I might get away with a little bit more if I just kind of lit like a softbox from the top. And that kind of worked, but the birds still really didn't like it. But the Phantom, you know, that's, I can't remember what the ISO was, but it was probably, I think it's like 200 or less. So, you know, we used as much as we could, and then we shot on Zeiss high speed prime so we could shoot at 1.4. And then Lori Longstaff was the focus puller, and it was like playing the hardest video game ever invented, because the birds wouldn't fly in one spot because they were a little freaked out, so they were flying all around. So, and we needed in the frame for about 2 seconds, right? Because then you have enough. The camera only records for 2 seconds, so getting it in the frame, in the light, in focus without any crazy reflection in the background and for the bird to be happy at the same time, because they have certain things that they display if they're not happy, like they kind of fly with their beak open.
You were shooting, were the birds flying towards the camera? It sort of seemed, but sometimes it was profile, but it sort of seemed,
yeah.
It was all,
well, different. The beauty of it is that they just fly in one spot, because, well, not actually, but they were flying all over the place, but basically they could hover, and because the wind is blowing through the tunnel, it's as if they're flying or gliding, except relative to the camera, they're basically in one spot. And we would shoot from the, we left a little bit on tape so we could, well, I was talking about the black tape to take away the reflections. We left certain sort of camera portholes that we thought would work, and then eventually we got inside.
So you had some operating leeway as well.
A little bit. Man, it was so hard.
Well, it looks great. And now that you explain how it was done, it's like, okay. Because I'm wind tunnel. Because there's no way you'd be able to follow them.
Yeah.
I mean, how do the scientists, how do they study them if it's in the dark?
Well, they have infrared cameras. And they do stuff like, you know, they put hummingbirds in there and have little sensors on feeders so that they can measure how much carbon dioxide hummingbirds exhale. You know, for whatever reason, you might want to know that. That's what this, you know, device allows them to do. So it's pretty cool.
So yeah, well, you had a lot of experience with dark stuff, because on location, there's a lot of dark stuff that you're shooting at night. And I was trying to think, just the sensitivity of digital cameras.
Right.
Like, some of them there's lights in it, but others it was just available. Like in the fields, you know.
Pretty much, yeah. And some of that stuff, actually, there was, Chris Romeike shot some stuff, some of the New York sequence that was out in the field at night. And I know that, we were shooting on the F-55, which is a relatively sensitive camera. We did a certain amount at night, though we were hoping to do some infrared night vision stuff.
Yeah, I was wondering. I was actually thinking it when I was watching the film. Like, wouldn't they go to infrared? Or maybe you don't want to. Maybe you want to just keep it real.
Well, that was... there was a shoot like that planned, but then there was some weather... there was some weather conditions that kept it from happening.
So did you do the one at the World Trade Center Memorial?
Yes.
That was amazing, just about the birds and how they, the guy said, yeah, we're going to turn the lights out.
Yeah, that was incredible. A great shoot.
Everything just, you can read, you could actually see the birds. You can get a sense of really the amount of birds that were in the air.
Yeah.
And then the concern. I mean, just watching the film, it makes you want to turn off all the lights in the city anyhow at night because of how many birds. I mean, you covered Toronto, which was like, you know, what, 500 in one day?
Yeah, right.
You know, birds going into the buildings. Now, what about, you did some macro, you did the macro photography as well?
Yeah, we had some macro photography for, there was a few different things with bugs. These coffee bearer borers that we shot in Costa Rica, which is a type of bug that eats coffee beans. And so there's a push to try to use birds as a way to control those pests as opposed to using pesticides. We had some other macro stuff of these neonicotinoid seeds. I can't believe I'm remembering all of these,
these names,
terms and stuff, because this was like actually a while ago. But yeah, these little jumping, can't remember what they're called, jumping beetles or...
So there was quite a variety of shootings in this doc. And this is, you probably had an idea going into it.
Oh yeah.
Was there some consistent challenges just in the regular shooting, like did you what you anticipated, the problems you anticipated, did they actually happen, or did it flow because of your prep?
Well, because of the prep, we usually knew what we were walking into. Yeah, for the most part, we kind of had what we needed. The challenges was mostly just lugging around the stuff that we needed, because we would usually, it would be me and Sue and our sound recordist, who was usually Jason Milligan, who's this documentary sound recordist I've worked with lots. And then we would have, if Josh was there, then we had Josh to help us. But sometimes we had like kind of a driver type person, or sometimes we didn't have anybody. But
well, that's the nature of documentaries. Totally. Is you have to be able to go with it.
For sure.
You know, you do as much prep. I mean, I guess it's like anything. Now, would you say your work, I mean, do you do lots of documentaries, or how do you cross over?
It's kind of a mix. I mean, I started more in fiction, and I was really interested in documentaries. So yeah, I put some feelers out there, and I ended up doing a feature with the NFB called Love at the Twilight Motel. And that was a really amazing experience. Just me and the director. It was all about hourly motels in Miami. And and it was just such an amazing experience. I met just a lot of really interesting subjects, and you know, we would shoot these like 5-6 hour long interviews in the middle of the night in like a motel.
By the hour too. Location by the hour.
So I've kind of, I guess in a way, like it's funny because the worlds are so different that I kind of feel like it's two totally separate careers in a way. Like I've sort of been pursuing both, and I do more fiction now. Like I've been doing more fiction features recently, but I still do it kind of comes in waves. Like I'm actually working on a couple docs right now, and I like being able to bounce back and forth because it's a lot of fun.
To go back to what's your package?
Yeah.
For the messenger, like, what was your lighting package? What did you bring with you?
Right. Well, pretty much the only things we really would light would be the interviews, which were another big part of the film. So these were mostly with these scientists that were following around. Usually I have a very simple lighting package. And actually, I have a process that I've kind of worked out over the last few years that I really like. That kind of comes more from the way that we work in fiction, which is usually larger sources, you know, 6x6 or 8x8 frames, and you know, on one side, and balance or negative fill on the other side. And in documentary, you see a lot of like 3-point lighting where people are just have like a chimera or something, and they have a bunch of little lights. And to me, I guess I don't really care for that style, or you know, that more traditional style. Like usually, I'd love an interview to kind of look like you know, like a shot from a movie.
They do. The interviews are beautiful.
Thanks.
They're very soft and they do the job, but they're unobtrusive. But they they did look like that. So it's
Well, you kind of want it to have depth and look engaging, and you know, and draw you in a little bit, but not feel. You know, oftentimes I find when you do have that sort of 3-point lighting look, it kind of bumps up a little bit the artifice of that. Because everything else you're doing is is natural usually. So what I've started doing is I have these backdrop kits, which are really simple. They pack up into nothing. It's basically like two little stands and a bar that you screw together that can go about 9 feet wide. And then I just bring a bunch of fabrics. So I have, you know, two of these backdrop kit things, and I can have, and I bring like grid cloth and ultra bounce and nets and stuff, and it all packs into nothing. And I find that I can set up in like 2 minutes. I put up something big and soft on one side, and I can have neg fill on the other side.
So you bounce the light off.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Do you get into any cutters or anything, or you just let it fall, just fall off?
Yeah. Yeah. Usually I look for a background that kind of lights itself, or something where I can play with the windows or doorways or something, just to, yeah, ideally the background kind of takes care of itself, and then I find a spot where, yeah, I can usually just have one light. I say 9 times out of 10, I have a diva kit, and though you could almost use any light, because really you're just putting it through a big diffusion, and I find that I'm surprised I don't see that more often, because I find these chimeras, they're not that big, so they're not very soft, and they, maybe it's just me, but I find they take forever to set up. So,
well, they can if you you don't get it in right, yeah. You gotta futz with it a bit, and they can take up space, and they're kind of direct. I mean, you can put as much stuff in front of it, but it never sometimes doesn't quite get, like, you know, that's great tips. Everyone should be copying your interview lighting, because it's, you know, people don't think much of interviews sometimes. Right. They think, oh, you just slap up, like you say, do the 3-point, but when you get it down to something, that it can add so much when it looks effortless, and it makes the person look great, and like you say, doesn't take you out of it,
right?
Because everything else is naturalistic.
Yeah, right.
That's very good points.
That's the goal, anyway.
That's the goal, anyway. So what was, okay, that's your small lighting package. I mean,
yeah.
And you had some negative fill with that. And what were the camera again that you used?
So we kind of used a combination, because we knew that we were going to be finishing, it was going to be 1920 by 1080. So we didn't need 4K at the time, but we needed something that could kind of cover all our bases and would be good for filming the birds too. And so I kind of settled on either the C300 or the F55. We ended up going with the F55 because I found that it just made a lot more sense to have the option of 4K, because shooting birds, having the option to do those shots in 4K, have that little extra resolution, it meant that if it needed to be stabilized, it could, if it needed to be reframed for whatever reason, or, I mean, one of the big advantages was that you can do a center scan, which basically gives you like almost like a 16 mil size sensor, so your 300 mil lens becomes a 600 mil. The downside is that because it's PL mount, and I didn't really want to convert the mount at the time. I don't think for the F55 there was something that would allow me to use Canon lenses. There was something that we used, that because I had some macro lenses and stuff like that, but I wanted to use the 1990 Cabrio lens for our kind of follow the puck lens, because it has a zoom rocker on it, sort of ENG style lens that's great for sort of general documentary shooting. But that meant that for the long lens, you know, the thing about these cameras that all have 35 mil size sensors is that you need a really long lens to get, you know, to
get those birds,
to get that magnification. So we had a 150 to 600 Canon Century, which is like I guess it's a rehoused Canon lens, but it's massive, and I'd used it before for a couple things, and there was that plus a doubler, which made it 300 to 1200, and then once I used the center scan, then that was like, you know, it was double that plus a bit, so it became what's that?
I mean, the digital age, what, that's amazing. I mean, you think in the film days that like, they just wouldn't happen.
Right,
just
right.
Amazing versatility.
Well,
you know, which is great.
Yeah. So that camera offered all of that in one package. I mean, the one thing about that is once you get that kind of magnification, it doesn't mean anything if you don't have a really solid tripod.
Okay.
So we carried two tripods with us. We had one it was, I know we were using a Sackler head. I can't recall exactly what one. I know it was bigger than what I usually have. I think it was, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was a bit, it was bigger than the
standard Sackler, you mean?
Well, it was, like, oh yeah, fiction, you know, like what? Fiction, I think it was the 7 plus 7.
Yeah. 7 plus 7, yeah.
And so, which is really quite a big head to be carrying around on a dock shoot, especially when you're like in the middle of the boreal forest or something. And we had two sets of sticks. We had a lighter set that I could jump around with when we were, we needed the speed. And then we had a set of like the Ronsford Baker. So anytime we were shooting this long lens stuff, we would lug over the tripod and we would, because any little...
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah. But, any little gust of wind.
But you had to. You have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's something that you don't necessarily think of. And I asked around, I started asking just around trying to figure out what people even do for this kind of thing. Because that was a thing that I didn't have a lot of experience with, was specifically this wildlife photography. A little bit here and there, kind of like more on the periphery of other documentaries, but not stuff where, I had to specifically go out and get this stuff. I mean, thankfully, my job was mostly involved the humans when it came to the stuff in the field.
But, that's great. Well, you probably got strong shoulders.
Well, it was fun to try to come up with ways to... I mean, one thing I learned is that you have to be on a Zoom because you need to be able to find it first and then crash in. But, I was trying different stuff to try to make it... I got this eye patch and I cut a hole out of the eye patch and put my, one of those contrast glasses you use to like look up in the sky to decide when the suns are going to... when the cloud is going to cover the sun.
Oh, you're trying to time it so you had the most light.
No, I used that. I needed, it was like a monocle so that I could set the camera up so that I could see out of my left eye to find the bird and then frame with my right eye, especially when they're flying. But,
did it work?
Kind of. It was kind of an experiment. It actually, yeah. Sort of worked.
Well, now you can share this knowledge.
It looked really silly.
And was there any experience in that documentary that sort of was outstanding that you really remember?
Let me think. Well, the 9/11 shoot that we did, which was we shot September 11th on they do this thing every year where they create these two towers out of light, which. I think they're all xenons, basically. It's this massive grid. They put two of them on the top of its parking garage. And there's a bird expert who supervises this because these two massive columns of light, they tend to trap with these huge swarms of migratory birds that are flying through because
they're attracted to the lights.
And they become confused by the light and then they kind of end up in this giant bird whirlpool of thousands of birds up above, and it's quite frightening actually. And we wanted to film this because this kind of demonstrated what happens to birds when they're flying at night, because New York and Toronto are basically in the path of these huge bird migrations. And it was just a surreal experience to be there at nighttime, seeing these huge columns of light and then looking up and seeing these birds. And it was such a surreal image because there were these lit birds against a black sky. It almost looks like a negative. And it was beautiful, also frightening at the same time because you could hear them.
You could hear all these
bird calls, like of these confused birds filtering down.
So birds are really attracted to the light that strongly in their migration.
Yeah, well, I guess...
in the confusion, of course.
Right.
Because they go to it, but then when they're in it, it sounds like they're confused according to the documentary.
Right, too. Right. And I think that, there's all kinds of different ways that tools that birds use to migrate. And I think the starscape is part of that. Time of day, like the actual length of day is kind of when they think when they know when to migrate, and basically they're following the insects. And that's where climate change is an issue, because they arrive somewhere and then the insects aren't there for one reason or another, and they have no food.
I like the part in the documentary about Mao Zedong. And
does the
three pests control. Yeah. It's like that is like,
I know, it's powerful,
right there. What's your latest project? Let's sort of have a little bit, because you sort of mentioned it's got some funny name to it. Is it a fiction?
ARQ. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
You know, before we
Yeah, we just shot this.
And this is a fiction.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, it's for Netflix, because Netflix is making features now. And so...
ARQ. So, gee, let me guess. What could it be about? Noah's Ark?
Oh,
No.
It stands for something, some obscure scientific thing. You'll never figure it out. It was written by Tony Elliott, written and directed by Tony Elliott, who is a good friend of mine who I've made some shorts with, and is a fantastic writer. He was a writer on Orphan Black, and so we've done a couple shorts together, and then this is his first feature. Yeah, it was.
What's it a little bit about? It's science fiction?
It's science fiction. I'm pretty sure on IMDb it already says that it's about time looping. Basically, it's all in one set, and it's a house interior, and it's the same time looping over and over. I think in terms of screen time, it's maybe like 15 minutes or so for a loop. I think story time is maybe about 20 minutes. And so it offered a lot of interesting challenges because you see the same, not the same sequence of events, because the events that are change with each loop depending on what happens, but it's the same time, so the lighting had to match with each different loop. So, you know, what was interesting about that is that we had to figure out how to light this that would, you know, serve the purposes of all the scenes we knew that were going to happen in each room and stay consistent. And of course, you do things from shot to shot, but overall, the approach needed to stay the same. And it was a fun challenge. It was a really fun challenge.
Yeah, a challenge after a documentary, you know, just having that control, and it's up to you.
For sure.
Opposed to the elements of a documentary.
Yeah, but it was crazy because every time we would go into a new room, like in the first week, you know, when we were shooting these rooms for the first time, it was like once you started shooting, it couldn't change. So it was, first week was totally nerve-wracking because, you know, in some cases I was seeing a room for the fully dressed for the first time that morning that I'm going to have 8 days in. And
establish you.
Yeah, it has to be established, and then... You know, and then after that, I can't really change it. So, yeah.
Sounds good. I guess just to, the final question, I think, would be just to find out how you got into the cinematography.
Yeah.
How did you get into the industry? Like, what is your background? Where are you from?
Yeah, well, I'm from the East Coast. I'm Prince Edward Island originally, and then I grew up mostly in Halifax. I was actually more kind of into the sciences when I was in high school. I just had an assumption that that was the route that I was going to go. And I got really interested in still photography at some point. And it was kind of a hobby to start, and then became sort of a full-time obsession where I had a darkroom in the basement, and I would spend days down there, and I did all kinds of, you know, really horrible part-time jobs to fund that, you know, buy chemicals to process negatives and stuff like that. Yeah, around the same time, I started to get really interested in movies. And at some point, I realized that there was this role on a film set called director of photography. And I think I was watching a behind the scenes of something.
Definitely.
And like Bob Richardson popped up. And it was this guy with like crazy white hair. And he was talking about his craft. And I realized like, oh, this is like a real thing that people do. And it's an art form. And so I became really interested in it and started going out and renting movies, you know, by the cinematographer. So I'd watch every movie I could find by someone in particular. And
when did you come to Toronto for school, or were you self-taught?
I went to Ryerson. Yeah, which was a great experience. And then, after I graduated, I spent many years trying to it's tough when you start, like, you know, when I graduated I didn't really know anybody in the industry, but I started doing a little bit of assisting and mostly working as an electric, actually, and that was a great foundation because I got to watch some really interesting cinematographers work and learned a lot just about how set runs, and I think that I would have actually happily have kept doing that, but I couldn't really make much of a living doing it. I was mostly volunteering. I did that for around a year, and then kind of with shooting like short films and stuff on the side, or really just whenever the opportunity came up. You know, I joined Lyft and started to do a few things there. Actually, that was where I met Cassandra Nicolau, who recommended me for The Messenger, like however many years later. I mean, any job I do now, I feel like I can trace it back to, you know, those beginnings day. Yeah, in a way, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so who hired you? What was your first gig that you would say was
my first gig? Well, it might have actually been for Cassandra shooting a short film called Congratulations, Daisy Graham. That was kind of my first, you know, first thing in fiction that wasn't one of my friends from film school. And I remember just like puking the morning of. Like,
oh, you were nervous?
I was just like really just felt like I had no idea what I was doing. And but apparently hit it well, you know, because she said she didn't realize years later that, and I was totally, you know, felt like I had no idea what I was doing.
You hit it well. Well, good things those days are behind you. You don't have to get so nervous.
Well,
you still get nervous?
It depends because every project is a bit different. You know, like I did the feature I did before ARC was Into the Forest with Patricia Rosema, which was, that was, you know, a big jump for me as well. It was sort of my first, it was a 669 project, my first union feature.
And Patricia was the director.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with her years ago.
Yeah, she was fantastic. And, you know, I probably felt the same way the first day of that I did working on that first short film.
Well, I guess that's it. Is there anything you want to add? Any advice to newcomers starting out at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think as far as advice to newcomers, which I think that some advice that I got early on, which is really just as much as possible trying to work on things that are just interesting and have integrity and are going to showcase your work. And that can be really difficult early on because obviously you need to pay the rent at the same time too. I saw an interview once with Roger Deakins when he was asked that same question. He said, marry into money. Because you need to be able to afford to turn down things and wait for something better to come up. And I don't know how much I did that just by mistake because I didn't know how to get the... I'm sure someone had offered me in those early days, had offered me like, a job shooting reality TV. Maybe I would have taken it because I was, you know, living starving off of Mr. Noodles. but I was just doing these little kind of arty short films. But those kind of are what built up to get me into... You know, it's just like one thing after it grows a little bit into something else.
Well, thank you, Daniel.
My pleasure.
This has been the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. The CSC is a nonprofit organization that has been promoting the art and craft of cinematography in Canada since 1957. Find out more by logging on to thecsc.ca. Thank you for joining us.